This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of October 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Will cutting police funding make Austin less safe?
If police spending leads to changes in the number of police on the street, that might lead to a change in crime rates.
The University of Texas at Austin and its response to COVID-19.
I don't believe that UT's overall response is really enough to, I guess, stop the spread.
And how Luby's cafeterias found early success.
Previous to that, there were very few eating out alternatives.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. Two billboards recently popped up along I-35 just outside Austin. The billboards say this: Austin Police defunded. Enter at your own risk. The signs were put there by a police lobbying group after the Austin City Council cut millions from the police budget. The sign asserts that if you spend less on police, crime will go up. But as KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports, that's not always the case.
In 2009, the city of Austin's police budget was about $230 million. A decade later, we were spending nearly twice as much on police. So with all that money, has Austin gotten safer over time? The answer is sort of. In 2009, the violent crime rate was 4.76 per every 1,000 residents in the city. To put it another way, that's one murder, rape, robbery, or aggravated assault per every 200 residents. Over the next couple of years, as we spent more money on police, that number trickled down. And then it went up a little. And then back down. And then up a little. So that by 2016, we had nearly the same violent crime rate as 2010, even though we were spending $130 million more on police. In other words, as spending on police went up and up and up and up, violent crime rates fluctuated.
There's no evidence that spending more on police all by itself does any good at all.
Bill Spellman's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a former city council member. And he says rather than asking how big the police department's budget is, you have to ask how that money's being spent.
There is some evidence that putting more patrol officers on the street has a small negative effect on later crime rates.
So will the city council's budget cuts affect the number of officers in Austin? The answer is yes. About $13 million of what the council cut from police represents the canceling of 3 cadet training classes. So no new officers for the next year. Although Police Chief Brian Manley has said he'll try to keep the same number of police on the streets. But the department estimates that by next September, we'll have fewer full-time officers than we had in 2014. Here's Emily Owens, a professor at the University of California, Irvine.
If police spending or changes in the police budgets leads to changes in the number of police on the street, that might, all else equal, is something that's probably going to lead to a change in crime rates.
Owen says a body of research suggests a relationship between police presence and lower crime rates. The idea is that if you see a police officer on the street, you're less likely to commit a crime. A study out of Princeton University found that cities that got federal grants to hire more police saw a 3.5% reduction in crime. The 8 experts I talked to for the story all agree that there's no correlation between the size of a police department's budget and crime. But what about the number of police officers and crime? Depends on who I asked. Some experts said research shows a relationship, and others said it didn't. So we'll have fewer police officers in Austin, and we may not know what that'll mean for crime rates. Which brings me to another point Owens made.
What I see in the sort of defund the police movement and the push to reduce spending on police officers is to be glib, not to reduce spending on police and then set that money on fire.
Owens has researched the effects that social services can have on crime. In one study, she found that building low-income housing in a neighborhood has the potential to lower violent crime rates. And while she and her co-author admitted that having more police might have had a bigger impact on crime, housing provided another social good. Well, housing. Which brings us back to the central argument of those who support taking money from the police department and spending it elsewhere.
Are there other ways we could spend this money? Does it all have to go to the police?
Scott Henson is the policy director at the nonprofit Just Liberty. So far, the council's re-spent $20 million of its proposed total $150 million in cuts. That money is going to public health, housing, and to a family violence shelter. Henson argues that if there's no connection between the size of a police department's budget and violent crime rates, why keep spending?
To me, this is an example of what normally is a conservative critique of government, where we keep throwing money at this problem on the assumption that more money makes us safer, but we don't really know.
Although, as I've mentioned, there is some evidence that spending the money on officers could keep crime rates down. Either way, the city council will continue to ask themselves and the public Henson's question, should this money be spent elsewhere? There's still $50 million of what they cut up in the air. Will they decide to keep it within the police department or dissolve some divisions and pay for something else entirely? They'll spend the next several months deciding. Audra McGlinchey, KUT News.
As the calendar turns to October this week, Austin public health officials are doing what they can to slow the spread of COVID-19. As KUT's Jimmy Moss tells us, there are several points of concern in the coming months.
Interim Health Authority Dr. Mark Escott says a second COVID-19 wave could be coming, but it is not inevitable. There are upcoming days that could be flashpoints for spreading the virus, though, with school and holiday activities. The county's largest school district, Austin ISD, reopened school for in-person learning next week. And Escott says there's a chance people will let their guard down during the holidays.
We're going to see it at Halloween. We're going to see it at Thanksgiving. We're going to see it at Christmas. Because people want to be more normal during those holidays. If we can resist that temptation, then we can ride through the winter without a substantial second wave.
Austin Public Health is hoping to maintain the area's 7-day moving average of new positive cases as flat as it has been the last 3 weeks, with a little more than 100 a day. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
The Austin City Council has approved a $15 million relief package to prop up live music venues, childcare providers, and restaurants that are struggling because of the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. KUT's Andrew Weber reports.
The funding is more or less a band-aid on a bullet wound, but it's meant to provide some relief as state and federal aid packages have not materialized and as hundreds of businesses are staring down possible closures. Live music venues and childcare businesses have cornered a lot of the discussion around council's plan, but ahead of yesterday's unanimous vote, many argued bars and restaurants haven't been given a fair shake. While music venues and childcare businesses can apply for two separate $5 million pots of money, restaurants and bars have to compete with venues for a third pot of $5 million in city grant money. Kelsey Erickson-Stroyfert is with the Texas Restaurant Association.
The restaurant industry has lost more revenue and more jobs as a result of COVID than any other industry. Respectfully, this scale is not reflected in staff's recommendations, which dedicate funding to live music venues and childcare specifically, but not to restaurants.
City Council will discuss more possibilities for restaurant-specific relief programs in the coming weeks. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
A ban on drinking alcohol in public in certain parts of East Austin was repealed this week by the Austin City Council. Natasha Harper-Madison is a council member who represents much of East Austin. She called the ban outdated and discriminatory. Let's hear what she had to say right before the vote.
Item number 18 is yet another step towards erasing inequities that have existed in our city for generations. This is also an example of how some of these inequities can be hidden in policies and practices that most of us don't even know exist. That is exactly why I sit in this seat, to uproot outdated practice and to speak out for those without the platform to speak for themselves. In the end, the things that separate us, the barriers that perpetuate disparity and keep us from experiencing life in the same way. Oftentimes, those things are written into policy and ordinance. Those barriers are literally paper thin. The key to a progressive community are ordinances that provide equity across the board. And with the passage of item number 18, no matter what side of the highway you live on, you will now be able to responsibly enjoy a beer while taking a neighborhood stroll.
The ordinance reverses the drinking ban in areas east of I-35, both north of the river and south of the river, but a public drinking ban remains in effect in downtown Austin, near the University of Texas, and along South Congress Avenue. College students are back on campus, even as most of their classes are online. And school leaders are struggling to send a unified message about how to handle COVID-19. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports from the University of Texas at Austin, where the administration's communication to students is sometimes at odds with the school's own actions.
We're on Guadalupe Street in the West Campus area of Austin, right in front of a nondescript five-story building. A weathered red banner stretches around the outside. It reads Taos Cooperative. Cooperatives, or co-ops, are basically student-run residential buildings. The approximately 40 residents at Taos decide rent, expenses, and now, how to respond to COVID-19. In the industrial-style kitchen, a resident in a mask wraps up a late-night deep clean.
I don't believe that UT's overall response is really enough to, I guess, stop the spread.
Taos co-op director and UT senior Serena Ermitano thinks her co-op community is taking COVID more seriously than the UT administration. She believes the decision to reopen is, in and of itself, a mixed message.
I think the reality is UT should be all totally closed. All of our classes should be online because all of these things where we're open at, like, this weird number of capacity and still hosting football games is really, to me, an incentive for people to move back and have these gatherings.
And off-campus gatherings are happening. At other co-ops, Greek life houses, and restaurants around Austin, which isn't too surprising.
It's a monumental task to ask young adults to basically act against their nature.
Anna Song is an associate professor of health psychology and the director of the Nicotine and Cannabis Policy Center at UC Merced.
And so what we're asking people in this age group, right, young adults, to do is to control impulses, to delay gratification, and delay gratification that comes from social interaction. All of those things are very counter to the way the brain is wired for young adults.
So, while UT expects students to follow public health guidelines that run counter to their instincts, the university hosts events that openly flaunt public health guidelines. So, it's September 12th. Charter buses from El Paso idle outside the UT football stadium. More than 15,000 people stream inside for the first home game of the season. A deep, booming voice instructs people to wear masks.
To protect Texas city and face coverings are required.
But here, just outside the stadium, compliance is low.
Look around you. There's three people there without masks. There's another over there. There's one person behind me.
Ed Malchek is a longtime Austin resident, and he thinks these games will lead to COVID outbreaks.
I don't think there's going to be a lot of games. I think it's too difficult. I figure 70% of the people here are wearing masks and the other 30% are not, and that's problematic.
The interim medical director and health authority for Austin Public Health, Mark Escott, has repeatedly pushed back on these games.
Packing 25,000 people in, even in a 100,000 seat stadium, introduces a lot of risk, not only to the people who were there, but to the community as well.
The 25% capacity is in line with state-level policy, and it assumes that other public health guidance is followed, like social distancing and mask wearing. Media access inside the stadium was restricted, so I got some steps in. Alrighty, I'm on the southwest side of the stadium on top of a parking garage, so I can see inside. So many people are not wearing masks. That was one pillar of UT's plan to start these again. You know, masks would be required. That is not the case. It's not being enforced. People aren't wearing their masks. So even though UT Austin smacked UT El Paso on the field, mask use, a key strategy in the fight against COVID-19, fell short. So, UT tells students to follow health protocols, but fails to do the same as an institution. Will the perceived hypocrisy affect how seriously students take the guidance?
You know, I think that students are constantly trying to read the tea leaves to understand how serious any organization or any authority figure is in what they've said.
Art Markman is a UT professor of psychology and marketing, and he headed up an academics planning group for the fall semester, so he's privy to many of the university's COVID discussions.
The Austin Public Health Authorities actually toured the facility during the game and came back with a very positive report about all of the precautions that were taken, the way that the stadium was organized, the social distancing that was going on.
Texas Public Radio sent an open records request to Austin Public Health to see this very positive report. And it did outline 8 positive observations, like hand sanitizer stations and good use of directional flow in hallways and entrances. But... Mark Escott with Austin Public Health again. At this press briefing, a few days after the game, he says he appreciates some of UT's efforts.
They ensured people had masks on entry. They had people spaced out at the beginning of the game.
But,
however,
UT didn't do enough.
We had some teams from Austin Public Health at the game. And what they observed is that as the game progressed, the mask came off and people started gathering close to the field.
According to the report obtained by TPR, mask use in certain sections dropped from about 88% at the start of the game to about 1% after 8 o'clock. In a follow-up email, Art Markman, the UT professor who described a very positive report, said he was just passing along what he heard. He encouraged TPR to reach out to the athletics department. We did, and they declined an interview. A UT spokesperson said protocols are under review and will be improved.
It's a 5-yard penalty, still first down.
UT's next home game is Saturday against Texas Christian University, but the school's battle against COVID-19 will continue until students head home for Thanksgiving break and when they return in January. Losing that matchup will cost the school and the Austin community much more than a football trophy. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in Austin.
Williamson County Sheriff Robert Schoedi is facing a grand jury indictment alleging he tampered with the video recording of the arrest of a black man who died after being repeatedly tased by deputies. KUT's Allison Ortegon reports.
The indictment accuses Schoedi of evidence tampering for allegedly destroying footage that showed deputies chasing and using force against Javier Ambler. The video was captured for the reality TV show Live PD in March 2019. Jason Nasor faces the same charge. He served as general counsel to the county attorney's office up until this year. The charge comes after a joint investigation opened in June by Williamson County District Attorney Sean Dick and Travis County District Attorney Margaret Moore. Dick rebuffed notions which Schoedi put forth that the indictment was, quote, engineered.
You know, obviously people that are charged with indictments always want to come up with some explanation or some sinister plot behind it. I think anyone that knows me knows that I'm driven very much by what's right and what's wrong and what the evidence tells us.
Schoedi was arrested earlier in the day but posted bail of $10,000 and held a press conference in which he denied allegations against him and attributed the indictment to a political agenda from District Attorney Dick. Both Schoedi and Nasor will have their first court date on November 30th. Alice Ortegon, KUT News.
A group rallied outside Capital Metro's headquarters this week opposing Proposition A. That's the ballot measure that would help fund a transit expansion in Austin. KUT Samuel King reports this group feels the ballot measure is poorly timed and too costly.
Prop A would increase property taxes in Austin to cover a big chunk of the cost of the $7 billion transit plan. The group that included East Austin residents argued taxes shouldn't go up while many families are struggling during the pandemic. Anaka Rivera also questioned whether the plan is truly equitable.
Citizens of Austin who support mobility and transit justice should reject Proposition A, which will further displace vulnerable communities. We can see these inequities play out in other states and other cities.
The plan includes $300 million to help prevent people from getting priced out of their neighborhoods if the new transit lines are built. Groups like the Austin Justice Coalition do support Prop A, saying Project Connect has the potential to reduce the impacts of long-standing inequalities in Austin. Samuel King, KUT News.
A cooler-than-average September has come to an end. As KUT's Mose Bushell reports, last month's weather was a welcome break from the severe heat this summer.
The temperatures might have felt unusually cold coming after an August that was one of the hottest ever recorded in Austin. But Keith White with the National Weather Service says, all added up, this September was only about 2 degrees cooler than average.
You know, pretty middle-of-the-road values. And we have over 120 years of data at Camp Mabry, and it was only the 35th coolest. So, you know, it wasn't anything super out of the ordinary.
The month also brought above-average rainfall, freeing up the region from drought. Looking ahead, meteorologists are expecting a drier and warmer-than-usual fall and winter, thanks to a La Niña weather pattern that's formed in the Pacific Ocean. Mose Bushell, KUT News.
Maria's Taco Express has been serving up breakfast tacos and more on South Lamar Boulevard for 25 years, but this will be the last year. The owner, Maria Corbalan, says she was just getting back to square one from a financial setback caused years ago by a former employee, and then the pandemic threw the business for a loop. Now, everything is for sale, from the lot Maria's Taco Express sits on up to the giant plaster sculpture of Corbalan that sits on top of the deck. And she does have a plan for Taco Express to live on in a different form.
I have bought my employees of 20 years plus NRV, and they're going to use Taco Express equipment, and they're going to open their own little mini Taco Express, going back to the old grounds.
Corbalan first started the business as a taco truck, and then 14 years ago, she moved into her brick-and-mortar location. She has not chosen a final closing day yet for the restaurant, but said everything will be sold within the next few months. The famous Texas cafeteria chain is liquidating its assets, closing some locations. There are efforts to keep the company going, and some Luby's locations have remained open during this giant shakeup. But all of this talk of Luby's going out of business got KUT's Jennifer Staten a little nostalgic.
I ate at Luby's more times than I can remember growing up in Austin. Fried fish, fried okra, Jell-O, iced tea. Luby's future might be uncertain, but its past is a fascinating mix of business and restaurant history. Back in 2006, I talked to Austin author Carol Dawson about her book, House of Plenty, The Rise, Fall, and Revival of Luby's Cafeterias. I thought I'd revisit a portion of that conversation, focusing on the origins of the home of the Luann platter.
Harry Luby founded Luby's in Springfield, Missouri in 1911. And this was 3 years after the very first Ford Model A rolled off the assembly line. So the whole notion of assembly line eating was a brand new idea. And it was a sign of modernity in the early 20th century. It's like, oh, there's a whole new way of doing things.
So what was his operating philosophy? How did he run his business?
He very much wanted to create a business that everybody would benefit from, the people who managed it, the people who worked in it. He very quickly, after he started establishing new cafeterias in new places, which he chiefly did because he wanted to keep refining his ideas. So he would get managers in to manage the place he had just left after a year of operation in order to go found a new one. He decided on a 60-40% split, which is unheard of in any sort of food industry operation. Management earned 40% net profits of all the profits per annum in any cafeteria. And then the ownership would get 60%. These were guys who would roll up their shirt sleeves and clean the grease traps, not just management, but the executives of Luby's. They knew how to do every job. They knew how to skin liver. They knew how to prepare every kind of vegetable. They knew how to mix every kind of salad dressing. They had mastered all the recipes.
How was the business side?
This created a sense of abundance. You know how a cafeteria line, you look at it and you go, oh my gosh, it's the groaning board, it's the feast. Luby's itself generated so much income from this spirit of cooperation and partnership and everybody doing well that atmosphere, I think, pervaded to the public. And as a result, Luby's was extremely successful. Even the tea ladies, you know, the tea ladies who push the carts around, they got stock options. Dishwashers got stock options.
Why did people respond so well to it?
Because it was a place where they could bring their families. When cafeterias first got started, and Luby's was the first cafeteria chain ever, it was a place where people could bring their families. Previous to that, there were very few eating out alternatives. Most people ate at home all the time. If they went out to eat at all, they in most small towns and small cities in America, there were only two options, and that was either a very expensive hotel dining room or a saloon. And you couldn't take your mother-in-law to a saloon. You just, you know, you can't take your kids to an expensive hotel dining room, which is formal and where there's a wait staff. This was a democratizing way for everybody to eat out. And it was a very inexpensive way to eat because it eliminated a wait staff. And it was a novelty. At the time cafeterias started, nobody had ever seen this mode of eating before and in general.
So how did Luby's decide where to expand and where to keep building and opening more restaurants?
Well, Harry first remained in Missouri for a little while. He opened cafeterias in Springfield and then in Joplin and St. Joseph. And then he decided to move on. And when he did, he followed the oil trail. Because at this point, oil fields were opening up in Oklahoma and then Texas. So he followed the oil trail, moving from one new oil boom city to the next, because cafeterias were the perfect place for those workers and even, you know, middle class and upper middle class people to eat in those communities. Harry founded his last own cafeteria in San Antonio. And after San Antonio, his son Bob and other members of the family, which he pulled in to get involved in the cafeteria business, started helping them found cafeterias in other Texas towns and eventually across 11 states.
Do you have a family history with Luby's? Did you grow up eating there?
Oh my gosh, yes. I think most people in Texas and a number of other states grew up eating at Luby's. My father started eating at what was then the New England Cafeteria, which was Harry Luby's early name for the Luby's cafeteria in Waco in 1924 when it first opened, and my father was an 8-year-old.
Well, Carol Dawson is the author of House of Plenty, The Rise, Fall, and Revival of Luby's Cafeterias. Thank you for sharing the Luby's history with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
KUT Weekend for the first weekend of October 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶